I'm Walter Stewart, and this, the title for this session is Ethical Imperatives in an Age of Interdependence. And in a minute, I'll tell you where that title comes from. It's very, very obvious. This is a very exciting time for me because I've always had a desire to sit on a stool in front of people and talk. Not only that it's all right, but I'm supposed to sit here in order that everything else will work. So we're going to try this on the stool. I want to start with where I intended to finish the session yesterday, and that was by mentioning another resource. The first three sessions that I had was using as the primary resource Jonathan Schell's book, The Fate of the Earth. If some of you haven't heard about that one, it's S-C-H-E-L-L, Jonathan Schell, The Fate of the Earth. Highly recommend it to you. Another resource that has come to me rather recently is this book, The Idea of Disarmament by Alan Geyer. One of the benefits of being president of the seminary is that all kinds of material comes across, addressed to either the president or the seminary. If anything comes to Pacific Lutheran Seminary without any particular title on it, it all comes to my office. And among the things that constantly come are advertisements for new books. And I look at those because every once in a while, there's one that really captures my attention. And every once in a while, they're either offered free or at a reduced price. And the one that came through this spring was The Idea of Disarmament by Alan Geyer as an introductory half price. So I couldn't resist that one. And it was a good decision on my part to get it. The Idea of Disarmament, the author is Alan Geyer. And while Jonathan Schell's book is really literature, you know, he is poet and author, and so when you read Jonathan Schell, you're kind of immersed in a literary experience. Alan Geyer has a lot of dates, statistics, which give considerable background to the various efforts that have been made since the discovery of atomic energy and the implementation of that through military weapons. Very valuable resource. If you want to know just what the various treaties or attempts at treaties are, where they took place, who attended, what documents came from them, and then have them set into an interpretive framework, this is an excellent resource. Now, he also has a particular point, and the title indicates his point. He thinks that the only response to nuclear weaponry is disarmament. And you notice the exclamation mark here. You read it one way, it's the idea of disarmament. He's going to be talking about an idea, which is disarmament. But as he himself says, you could also put it, disarmament, the idea. In other words, he is taking disarmament that has been looked at generally as something that is preposterous, obviously out of the question, the very idea that anyone would suggest. So he wants to take that one and say that, in fact, the subtitle is Rethinking the Unthinkable, and turning that around. Thinking the unthinkable has been attached to the thinking about the unthinkable process of wiping out the earth. And he's turning that around and said, in fact, people have talked about disarmament as if it were just as unthinkable a thing as wiping out life. And he wants to rethink that unthinkable. So while he's providing all of this data, he is also providing an argument for taking seriously, as a serious and possible idea, the matter of disarmament. Well, I just want to call that to your attention. I don't want to spend additional time. But I do want then, as an introduction to this section, to read a couple of things that he has quoted toward the back of the book, because the what I want to do today is to, partly working on the three sessions that I've been dealing with first, the meaning of the fact that we do have nuclear energy at our disposal, and then secondly, the possibility that this might be used to cause the extinction of the human species, And then the third session, his thought that we need to work toward a different system of world government than independent sovereign states and move toward some kind of unified governmental process. Now this fourth one wants to use all of that as background and say, where is the church in all of this? And to present to you a particular document that has been put together by the church as a response to this, and to see what we think of that in the light of the situation as we have it. And of course, it isn't only my sessions that have been dealing with that, so if you've gone to any of the sessions by Lowell Erdahl or Jerry Folk or myself, those issues have been raised. And yesterday afternoon, we went to hear Rudy Edmonds' discussion of the care of the earth, looking at the conservation resources as a geologist, and it also that's also a part of the situation that this fits to. So it's generally looking at the world situation, what has one church said about it? That's what we want to look at. And I want to start by just raising the question about whether or not the church does have a role in all of this. Does it make sense even to think about the church having a role in responding to global situation? And Alan Geyer starts a chapter called The Theology of Peacemaking by quoting Bishop Otto Debelius of Berlin. Remember, he was one of the heroes of the Second World War, a Lutheran church leader in Germany who refused to follow the party line in Nazi Germany, and so was looked upon as a one of the resistance leaders from within the church. And Geyer doesn't date it. He says a generation ago. I don't know when Debelius died, but you know. Let's see, he would have been president of the World Council of Churches. Church historians, scholars, when was that of Debelius? Would have had to be about, I suppose, 30 years ago or so that he's talking about. But anyway, at that time, Otto Debelius said, "The church no longer has the power to guide the happenings of the earth. There is not the slightest doubt in my mind that the bomb will be used and the world will destroy itself. Perhaps the only task of the Christian in this age is to prepare the human species to die, to stand by to administer extreme unction to expiring humanity." Well, that's hardly a theme quotation for the politics of hope. But it does indicate what one leader of the church was thinking probably 25 to 30 years ago, at a point when the bomb was much less of a threat than it is now. But Geyer doesn't leave it at that. He also has in here a statement that came from a meeting of representatives of the churches of the USSR and the USA who met in Geneva in 1979 in a consultation in disarmament. So here again are church leaders now in 1979 representing both the United States and Russia. And it goes on for several pages, but as an indication of their thoughts as to the role of the church, one of the things that they pledge themselves to do is to urge our churches in their teaching and preaching programs to emphasize the biblical vision of peace and also to stress the devastating social and personal consequences of the arms race. Now remember, this is the leaders of the churches of Russia as well as the United States. And so obviously they feel that there is a role for the church. And this is not the only one, but certainly among them they pick out where the churches in teaching and preaching programs to emphasize the biblical vision of peace and to stress the devastating social and personal consequences of the arms race. I think that's an interesting combination of taking a biblical theme of peace, which is not really an arguable thing. Naturally, if it's in the Bible, the churches would teach it. But to pick that out, but then to add, and in the light of that, to stress the devastating social and personal consequences of the arms race. So to be very specific in the application of that. And then this fits with the fact that we're moving toward the celebration of Christmas on Sunday, the closing paragraph. "Finally, our sisters and brothers, we call to your attention the authoritative predictions that the nuclear war by the 1990s is an increasing probability. In that decade of high risks, we will be approaching the end of our millennium. Even now, only 20 years separate us from the moment when we'll be called upon to mark prayerfully the bi-millennial anniversary of the coming to the world of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace. Of course, let's see, this would be the, if you start from zero. Dan, you said we had to start at four, didn't you? 4 BC for Christ, so 4 plus 1982 is 1986th anniversary of the coming of the Prince of Peace. Question in the 2000th anniversary, how shall we meet that day? In what state shall we present our planet to the Creator? I like that phrase. In what state shall we present our planet to the Creator? Shall we be a blooming garden or a lifeless, burnt out, devastated land? Maybe sets the context now for moving ahead. On the one hand, a rather pessimistic view of what the church can do, preparing us to die. The other one as a force to make sure that we continue to live. And that I think to emphasize the fact that the Lord is coming, and that we want to put the decision as to when the Lord brings things to completion in the Lord's hand and not to take it into our hands and try to advance that date. Or postpone it, I suppose, for that matter. That'd be another question. Well, Alan Geyer then speaks in the book of the role of the NGOs. Does those initials mean anything to anybody, the NGOs? The NGOs are the non-governmental organizations. Geyer says that ultimately there is no substitute for courageous leadership. There is no substitute for courageous leadership in this particular issue. Now the question is, who is going to exercise the leadership? And he says the very vehicle of leadership must be a public vision of shared values and attitudes. Those do not simply spring from the heads of presidents. Previously, he had talked about how the United States presidents, both Republican and Democrats, really had failed to exercise the leadership. So he says, we can't really expect that to come from presidents. They are nurtured primarily by non-governmental institutions, schools, colleges, media, associations, churches, synagogues. These are the vision-making centers of a free society, where attitudes toward security and disarmament must be remade. It is in and through their capacities for attitude generation that the defenses of peace must be built. So Alan Geyer is saying that the church is one place where we'd expect leadership to emerge. And the particular kind of leadership he's looking for from the churches, as well as other non-governmental organizations, is to create the attitudes, to help to create the attitudes upon which the defenses of peace must be built. In 1970, the Lutheran Church in America, at its fifth biennial convention in Minneapolis, adopted a statement called World Community. And the subtitle is Ethical Imperatives in an Age of Interdependence, therefore the title for this session. I want to look at this statement as an example of what one of the NGOs, specifically the church, has written as an attempt to be one of those vision makers, to generate among its membership, but also beyond that, the kinds of attitudes upon which peace can be built. It is 1970, and one of the things we want to be looking at, have things changed so dramatically in those 12 years that the statement is no longer relevant? On the other hand, if things stayed the same, or was the church visionary enough to, in 1970, being able to say something that is relevant to 1982? Well, we want to look then at what the LCA has done. And I'm not saying this as opposed to something the ALC might have done. I just happen more familiar with this statement. And so I want to use this with the thought that generally in this kind of statement, what comes out of the ALC usually is quite similar, has been in recent years, to the LCA, or the LCA to the ALC, depending on who picked up the issue first and did the basic research. So I'd expect that the ALC would be happy to, maybe not happy, but willing to endorse a good deal of it. So I'm not presenting it as an LCA thing as such, but something from our Lutheran community.
Not everyone in Minneapolis was happy either.
You there, Paul?
Yeah.
Okay. The basic imperative It says ethical imperative, but I think really it's saying that there is one imperative. And the basic imperative is, basic imperative is to realize the oneness of the human family. Or another phrase, to fashion the world community. WC, that's not water closet, that's world community. Okay. That's the imperative, to realize the oneness of the human family. Or another way of phrasing the same thing is to help to fashion the world community. Now, on what basis does the LCA say that the oneness of the human family is a valid imperative? The first basis is experience. That's where the church starts. How do we know this is an imperative? Well, if you look around and you look at the state of the world today, you can see both threats that exist, one of them being the nuclear threat, but also the depletion of resources, overpopulation, and so on. And then noting how much in touch with one nation another is, the fact that it's impossible to be isolated or independent as nations today. But also to note that there are opportunities that exist in the world today for making this happen. So on the basis of both the threats and the opportunities that are observed in the world, in other words, it's saying anyone, you don't have to be Christian or LCA, you can just look at the world and you can see that there are things going on, and say that the oneness of the human family is something we have got to work toward. But then it also appeals to particular understandings of the church as another authority for this statement. And that is what we would find in scripture or theological formulations. And it refers first to the natural oneness that there is in the human community, which is saying in its origin the human community is one, or in Adam we are one. I think we could say in Adam and Eve we are one. And then the other one is what it calls the eschatological oneness. Eschatological having to do with the destiny, or the oneness which it says is in Christ. So in its origin, that is at the very point of creation, and in its destiny, where it's all moving to. As the Bible and our theological understandings instruct us, it is toward the oneness of the human family. We have neither taken the greatest advantage of our origin, nor have we moved toward our destiny until the oneness of the human family is established. And then it adds almost parenthetically, and besides that, the Bible says we also have a kinship and a responsibility to the earth. So there's also a sense in which the oneness is expanded beyond the human family to the total creation. But the emphasis is on the family. Now, as a theological aside, I was trying yesterday to earn my keep as someone who's called theologian, so I want to add another little one here, is that you have two different kinds of revelation that are appealed to. One is general revelation. General revelation being the kind of thing that we can find out about God and his purposes just by looking around. And that anyone who is observing what's going on ought to be able to find this out. Might not say it's God at work, but can observe it. And that's experience. When we look around the world and we see the threats and the opportunities for oneness, that's general revelation. The other side is specific or special revelation. And that's the revelation that comes to us specifically through Scripture and particularly through Jesus Christ. And so the appeal to the natural and eschatological oneness, which we find in the Scripture, that's the appeal to special revelation. So in a church statement, it makes sense that if we're trying to communicate both with ourselves as a community, as well as the larger world community, which this wants to do, that we would appeal both to that information or observation that anyone ought to be able to see, as well as to that special source of information that we have and call special revelation, or Scripture, but particularly the revelation in Jesus Christ. All right, that's the overt lesson in theology for the day. Now we'll go back to speaking theologically, but not being too self-conscious about it. Now, after the imperative, to realize the oneness of the human family, or to fashion the world community. There are a number of what the statement called judgments. And here we come to the place where the church is trying to say, what are the particular objectives or strategies that we ought to have in mind as we work toward the oneness of the human family. Now, I think, as I thought about this, when we talk about a politics of hope, if we take seriously the things that are being said here at Holden about the environment and nuclear energy and so on, it does feel fairly threatening. Bobby said we ought to have a subtitle for this. Is this Holden, Gloom and Doom? And I thought, but there's supposed to be hope in the midst of all this. Now, if by hope we mean to find some piece of evidence upon which we can pin with certainty that it's all going to turn out all right. Now, one way of doing that is to say God is going to make it turn out all right. And that's one comfort. I have that comfort. Except I don't know how God is going to do it. And that makes me a little bit uneasy. So I would like to have some kind of intermediate basis for hope. In the meantime, while I'm waiting for God to show his hand, I want to have some feeling that I am participating and at least seeking the direction where we might converge our actions and God's at some point. And what I'm saying is that if that is the hope we're looking for, we're not going to find it by saying, aha, here's the solution. I know this is the way it's going to turn out, and this is exactly what I have to do to make it come out that. If that's hope, we don't have hope. We don't have anything except that eschatological last point. But I think another basis for hope is to say we've looked at the situation and we've thought about it seriously, and to the best of our knowledge, gained from both general and special revelation, this is where we ought to be moving. And here's what the church is trying to say. This is the way it looks. We ought to be making statements, creating attitudes, taking actions which undergird, move toward rather than threaten or move us off in a direction other than the one of this human family. Now, it's hopeful, I think, to be able to say, yeah, I think now I've got in mind the direction I need to be moving. And then secondly, to say, now what are some of the things that ought to happen if we're going to approach that goal? To think that through and to come up with three or four or five different things that we could be doing or teaching, or moving toward. And then to begin to take steps in actually making that happen. Now, we don't know that that's exactly right. We won't find out until later on. But there is hope, I think, and confidence and motivation when we come to the point, at least where we're saying, I know that this is where I can do what I can do. And I know that these are some of the steps I want to begin taking. It's a little like career clarification. Although that statement, which is interesting, is beginning to be heard among 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds and even 40-year-olds now. What am I going to do when I grow up? And to be constantly in that state is to be kind of ruthless. And you're pulled in this direction and that direction. And it's not a very hopeful situation. You're just kind of waiting for something to take a hold of your life and move you. But if you think it through and say, I think what I've got to do is that's one of the things I'm familiar with. Another one is I decided that I shouldn't continue with Sunday. And I have heard both of those decisions, and both of them have the same effect. It's a freeing, a releasing, a hopeful kind of thing to say, I'm not sure that this is the right decision in the long run, but for now I know that this is the way I move. That I ought not to be a pastor, and put that aside and take something else, or this is the direction I want to go with the pastor. And then to be able to take steps to bring that into being. Decide you want to be a pastor, send it to the application form, to the catalog, and begin to take steps. You begin to feel better already. Or to say that at the end of this quarter, I'm going to leave seminary, and I'm either going to apply for a different graduate college, or I'm going to start looking for employment or something. Okay. That's hopeful. Makes one hopeful about life. And I think we attach it to this. So I'm saying that if the church as an institution can get a hold of a goal and come come to some agreement on the strategy or program that will move us in that direction, then the church can become hopeful. And if the church becomes hopeful, that's an awful lot of people. And then if the churches can get together and so on. So this is how I think this fits in with the politics of hope, is to begin actually to draw some conclusions and to suggest some directions. All right, the first thing, the first judgment that goes with this goal is the establishment of a global civil order. Lutheran Church likes to use the term civil, and it really likes to put it together with order. Yeah, civil order. You've got some Lutheran working for you. Even if it's not good, Lutherans are more comfortable if you have civil order than if you don't. Okay? But this wants to be a little more specific about the global civil order. The Lutherans say that the nature and function of government is actually to be a part of God's activity. That's the nature of government. So when we're going to have a session tonight on some of my best friends are politicians, that's Lutheran. Because politicians, if they're a part of government, civil order, are seen as by Lutherans as a part of God's activity. For the advancing of justice and well-being and the preserving of order. So the establishment of a civil order which does two things, preserves order, and secondly, advances human justice and well-being. All right, that is going to be the purpose of the global civil order, to do globally what is to be done on a national basis now. Our government has its function to be a part of God's activity, to preserve order in this land and to advance justice and well-being. This statement is saying we've got to begin thinking about this same function, but on a global basis. On the basis of the present situation which has been identified. And at this point, it is saying, this means transnational structures of law and authority. Transnational structures of law and authority. Now notice at this point it's not calling for a world government. It's not going as far as Jonathan Schell went in the book we were talking about yesterday, where it talks about giving up national sovereignty. That may be an implication of the statement, but it's not asking for that. It is saying that along with the present national governments, you need some structures which transcend or cut across structures of law and authority, which will advance justice and order within pluralism. That's important, pluralism. And that's just recognizing that we have a great deal of differences among ourselves as the nations of the world. And this statement doesn't say we have to begin thinking the same all of a sudden as to how everything is to be done. But it has to be something that cuts across the various governments and nations, but at the same time allows for the differences. Now that calls for a lot of discussion how you're going to do that, but I just want you to know that that's recognized, that there are differences. And it doesn't say all of a sudden we all begin thinking as democratic form of government, or all of a sudden beginning thinking communist form of government. There has to be some room for that pluralism, and at the same time recognizing this oneness. Now it points out one specific transnational structure of law and the advancement of justice that exists today. You can guess what that is, the United Nations. Now this is 1970, 1982, still have the United Nations as the primary existing structure, transnational structure. And it says concerning the United Nations that we should have universal membership. I think in 1970 China was not yet a member. People's Republic, was it, of the United Nations? So I think that was behind this statement, universal membership. That the People's Republic of China ought to be included, that you can't have full-scale dialogue and cooperation unless all of the parties are allowed to come to the meeting. And I think that's a goal that's been pretty well realized at this point. I don't think there are any major representatives that are outside of it. I guess the PLO, with the one exception, and that's not actually a government, but there's some thought that it ought to be represented. But it's fairly universal. And then the second thing that it points to is the International Court of Justice, which is something that precedes the United Nations. I think it comes out of the League of Nations. And I don't know if you realize it, but there is a statute that has to do with the International Court of Justice. And there is a rider that goes with that. And some of the nations that have subscribed to the International Court of Justice have said, but we reserve the right finally to judge ourselves. In other words, if the International Court of Justice is to hand down a decision which, well, let's say it finds the United States guilty on some particular thing. The United States is in the International Court of Justice system, but has that sense, reserves the right to say that it will not accept the judgment on itself. Rather serious reservation. I think we're one of few. I don't know what other ones do, but we're one that does. And the statement is saying that there should be a repeal of the self-judging reservations. In other words, if we're going to get into this, we can't just put one toe in and say that even we reserve the right to pull out even that one toe out if the water is a little colder or hotter than you want. And it says that the system of justice ought to be genuinely multinational. That is, if it's an instrument of the strong to the exclusion of the weak are not going to feel too comfortable about being within that system. So it can't be one to which the advantage is always given to the more powerful. So we would say similar to what our system of justice ought to be. It ought not to favor the powerful against the weak. I need to mention the other parts of this, but to do it in less detail, so we have some time to talk about this. A second judgment that goes with this is that human rights need to be thought of as universal rights and world concerns. Human rights as universal rights, meaning that the citizens of the United States ought not to depend on their rights being affirmed on this particular government. And by the same token, citizens of Russia ought not to have their rights dependent on their government, nor the blacks in South Africa dependent upon the government of South Africa. But that the rights of the human family ought to be guaranteed on a global basis. That is, because whatever rights there are that apply to the human species, why? Because we are part of the global community, not because we have a particular color or race or citizenship. And therefore, it ought to be a matter of world concern. That's something that the total human family ought to be caring about, is the human rights of all of the people, regardless of where they are. It points specifically to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the related conventions or treaties that go with that. It points out that there is a woefully insufficient sense of human worth. And probably this would be one thing that would not be better in 1982 than in 1970. I'm not aware that the violation of human rights is in a better state of affairs 12 years later. So I think this human rights judgment needs to be made even more emphatically. And points out that the churches have been a part of the problem in the violation of human rights. And therefore, the churches can't stand outside and say, what a terrible thing the world outside of the church does to people. It has to look to its own policies to make sure that it corrects its violations, as well as being a voice for them. All right, human rights. The third area is that natural resources, third judgment, should be the object of international coordination and control. And it again picks out two areas. One is the resources that exist within a nation ought to be conserved in coordination with the whole world community. That gets pretty close to home, doesn't it? It says that our oil pumping policies in the United States ought to be thought of in terms of the total resources and needs relative to petroleum products. Rudy Edmonds' session yesterday was getting at this, giving us a rundown, kind of an inventory of natural resources, particularly in this country, And the application here would be, but the LCA is saying, and as we look at those policies, we shouldn't have in mind just our own needs, but the needs of the whole world regarding those resources. And pointing out that we are not independent as far as resources go. We depend upon imports of particular resources. And so we're already in an interdependent network. We need to think of that as something that's not just us and the particular supplier nation for us, but the whole community. And then the other part of that is what he calls the international international public domain of resources, the polar areas and the sea and the air. And I think there has been some progress in space. There have been some treaties on space, and I think also in the North and South Poles. And there is a proposed treaty on the use of the sea, but the United States has refused to sign that today. Now that's another detail, and I don't have the details on this, except that it's a live thing. It's before the United States to ratify right now. And the current administrative policy is not to sign that for various reasons, and mainly because it does not want to be limited in the way it exploits the resources of the sea. But the LCA is saying that's another part of another piece of the oneness of the human community. Then a fourth judgment is that security and war prevention require an alternative to the military solution. Now that comes most closely to what we've been talking about the last few days. It's saying if we want to have security as a family, if we want to prevent war as a family, there has to be an alternative to military buildups or the deterrent system that we talked about. Now, what are the alternatives mentioned by the LCA? That there be an international legal framework for arms control. An international legal framework for arms control. Now, this is where it's different from Jonathan Schell, who said you get to give up national sovereignty before you can even talk about disarmament. This statement assumes that you've got the systems of national sovereignty going, independent nation states, but there is, kind of overarching that, some legal framework, particularly for arms control. And that's the kind of thinking that Alan Geyer is doing. As you recognize sovereign states, but then you have a particular framework for arms control. And this statement is saying it's nuclear arms and all weapons of mass destruction. One of the strengths of this statement, as I read it, is it's saying the only problem to the oneness of the human family is not nuclear weapons. And it's not even weapons generally, but it's resources and human rights and all of these other things. So this is a comprehensive look at it. The one piece of that is weapons of mass destruction, and one piece of that is nuclear weapons. So what some of us have been concentrating on as the issue involved in preserving the oneness, approaching and preserving as the nuclear, this statement sees it as one piece. Not an insignificant one, but one piece. And it's interesting to note that it encourages the United States to take unilateral action to create a hospitable climate for arms control. Now, it's not saying unilateral nuclear disarmament by the United States. But it's suggesting that there are some actions that the United States can take on its own that will create the climate for more widespread arms control. It doesn't say what those are. And we could talk about what some of those things might do. But at least it's saying we're in the United States. Say to the United States, we can at least do some things without waiting for Russia or Great Britain or any other that will create the climate, that will say we at least want to open our living room and to provide coffee and tea if you should happen to want to come and talk with us. We can't force you to talk. We want to say that the door's open and the coffee pot's on and come and talk with us, which is much different than and of having a padlock on and say, if you can guess the password, you can come in and talk. That's not a hospital requirement. And then the reallocation of resources that now go toward weaponry reallocation of those for peaceful purposes. Also under this matter of alternatives to the military solution are the liberation of oppressed people, recognizing that as long as people are oppressed, we can't have peace. If you can't have peace, then you don't have war prevented. And it's even recognizing that violence by oppressed people ought not to be seen primarily as something that has to be gone into and put down at all costs, but that violence by oppressed people ought to be looked at as a sign of the legitimate frustrations and aspirations of oppressed people. So on the one hand, we're saying that violence must be restrained at all costs. But on the other hand, we have to say that there are some places where violence is almost legitimate. It's the only thing that people can do if they're oppressed, is sometimes to make a noise or to strike out. So that's a part of it. Now, the Lutheran piece comes in strongly in this one. It says, as Lutherans, we recognize the need for civil order. It comes in again at this point. There is a need to restrain the human tendency to violence. It's a part of the fall, the tendency to violence. So the Lutheran Church is not a pacifist institution at this point. Total nonviolence group. It says, realistically, you know, you've got to have some means of restraining people at work in the world. And so to get away with the peacekeeping force entirely just is not realistic. This is the Lutheran understanding of sinners as well as saints. Really, it's the strength of that fall of Adam and Eve, the original sin, is that there's never going to come a point where we can feel completely trustful of one another's peaceful intentions and to carry them out. So it's saying there has to be some peacekeeping force at work. And this needs to, the United Nations has a peacekeeping function and so on. And then again, it speaks particularly to the churches. The churches must work toward lessening the nuclear peril. Once there's no mistake about that. Anything else the church does, it must work toward lessening the nuclear peril. And it must at the same time work toward realizing a greater degree of justice for the poor of the world. So the two things have to go hand in hand. I think it wants to say, if there were some people in the church who would say, church has got to put all of its energies and resources into nuclear disarmament. This statement would say, but at the same time, you've got to make sure that a great deal of energy is being put into establishing justice among the oppressed people of the world. Because peace, which is merely the absence of the nuclear threat, is not peace, unless there is also the condition of justice. So it's justice is put alongside of survival as a goal. That's part of the oneness, survival and justice. Okay, then the sixth one and the fifth one. The poor of the world must become full members of the community. What was that Hebrew word that John Schramm was telling us?
Anawim.
Yeah. That was more in a religious sense, but I think here it would be anawim of the world must become full members of the community. Those who are in a situation of really having no hope except in God. Those people must be guarded in full membership. If they want to wait patiently for the Lord, they may. But the rest of us can't say, that's your station in life. We say, no, we want to bring you in as full members of the community. And that has to do with the development of other nations, increased aid from the have nations to the have nots. And that would be true within nations as well as outside of nations. It says the scandal is the fact that the wealthy nations have not generously used their resources for the development of the have-not nations. Too often we have, even the aid that we've given has been tied to a particular political objective of ours. We cannot tie it to a particular political objective. Continue sending the missionaries, set up hospitals, education, help people with agriculture, evangelize. But you've also got to advocate with the government that it too will give massive aid. And then it even gives a role of the indigenous churches. Now, indigenous churches is a rather chauvinistic statement, because it implies that an indigenous church is those of in missionary countries, like Japan and Tanzania. The indigenous church would be that which is coming from the people. Well, presumably we are also an indigenous church. And but it really has to do with these other countries, that as they establish, they ought to be challenging their own governments also to take necessary steps. And then finally, the church, the last judgment, the church has a God-given responsibility. That's pretty heavy. A God-given responsibility to contribute to the building of a world community. Church has a God-given responsibility to contribute to the building of a world community. Now, how does the church do this? First thing is study. That's often where we start as a church, to study the issues. That's what we're trying to do here. You cannot effectively move toward the oneness of the human family if you don't know the facts of the case. So the study, I think the studying we've been doing here at Holden is exactly what is being called for. Secondly, it must represent to government national policies which are consistent with that. It's interesting, in 1970 it uses that word represent to. What it really means is be advocates of. But I think in 1970 the churches weren't quite ready to call themselves advocates. That sounded too much like lobbying. So represent to, that is take the case to. I think it means being advocates. We as the church are saying to the government, our own government, these kinds of policies ought to be undertaken by the government if we're going to realize this kind of objective. Joining cooperative organizations, joining with other church groups as well as other NGOs, non-government organizations, to move in these directions. Now that's three different ways. One is study, find out what's going on. Advocate, suggesting to other agencies what they ought to be doing, and action of its own. And this joining cooperative organizations, suggestion is that if we are going to be effective in our own actions, we really need to join with other organizations. So study, advocacy, action. And then one of the things that it mentions particularly is that while the churches have often been the most parochial or provincial, only wanting to talk to other Lutherans, sometimes not even other Lutherans, but our own kind of Lutherans, sometimes only wanting to talk to other Protestants, sometimes only wanting to talk to Protestants in particular countries, saying the churches must create the opportunities in which persons representing the various points of view can come together. Now this would be both church people, but it also could be non-church people. So the church actually sponsoring opportunities to bring people together at different points of view. And can do that as a, in a sense, as a neutral organization, and not having a political axe to grind, has this goal, but that's not tied to a particular political kind of organization. Be the agency to bring people together. Okay. So let me review. This is the imperative to realize the oneness of the human family, which means to fashion a world community. And there under that would be a global civil order established. Human rights are to be universal rights and of world concern. Natural resources should be the objects of international coordination and control. Security and war prevention require alternatives to a military solution. The poor of the world must become full members of the community. And the churches have a God-given responsibility to contribute to building the world community. Now what we need to do is to evaluate that as a strategy for the church. Is this the kind of thing that can give us hope as a church? Where we can with confidence say, yes, that's where we ought to be moving, and these particular things are being suggested. If we actually take them seriously and move, we're going to be moving in that direction. Which would mean, is this imperative valid? Can we accept that? Are these judgments valid means of meeting the imperative? Are they comprehensive?
Are some major things left out? And can they be implemented? And if so, where do you start? These would be the things to ask. So now for discussion purposes, how does this sound to you as a strategy? Is it something that sounds right to you, that if we could actually do some of these things, you could feel more hopeful about the situation? Or just, what do you think about it? Violently disagree with anything?
No. Well, no, I agree with the conceptual framework and the ideas. What I see little of is penetration of those ideas to the local level, to the local community of churches, to the congregation. Little dialogue about this kind of issue. That's the kind of thing that's going to be very controversial at the local congregational level for the most part, and that one of the primary tasks of the church is going to take that kind of a position is to create a vehicle for dialogue and consensus building within the congregations, and I see little of that going on.
All right, so one thing that would have to be done if this is going to be effective is some means of communicating this to the, this is a convention, 600 members of the LCA. Make this statement meaningful, workable, applicable to the millions, several million members of the congregation. Okay. Now, is it possible? Can you see ways by which the church could do this? That's not, I'm asking you to show me how, but I'm saying, and you're kind of left at a loss as to whether this could never be gotten any further, or can you see ways that happens?
It's one of the things that bothers me about the church, which is that it seems to me there's this implicit contradiction. We tell ourselves that our church, just put it down to a local level, a congregation, that the church is like an umbrella where everyone, regardless of their opinions, our sisters and brothers together, and we struggle together, and yet I buy very heavily into this sort of what I want to call an imperative that I see, and yet I guess I hear your statement very strongly. How does this happen? Because the other part of the concern of the church, obviously, on a local level, is outreach to its community and to draw people into its community. Yeah. And the church says basically, well, now we don't want to speak too loudly or too strongly because Mr. and Mrs. Jones will be offended and they won't come to church.
Well,
and we don't build a new building.
Where are the offensive features in here?
Global war.
Right at this point or the next one?
Probably, I think the imperative is vague enough so people can live with it.
Okay.
But I think when the judgments start coming, people start saying, you know, then they're going to win, and Somalia is going to tell us whether or not we can drill off our continent's shell.
All right, so as soon as we got, if we were kind of to trick people, get people to agree about the oneness, it really is hard to disagree with that, I guess.
I think that oneness is a real problem
okay.
with so many people. If we can say greater cooperation within the family, mm-hmm. I think we might have a better way of getting around that. When you say oneness, they immediately see, hey, they're going to make all the governments more, and they're going to throw us all away. So that's just one suggestion.
Well, for this particular statement, we could say, try to make clear that this is not a political statement to begin with. I mean, we'd have to be realistic that as soon as we start, the first thing that follows from it is a political statement. But this is not purely political. We're not immediately saying a world federal government. So I guess you're saying we'd even have to talk about this oneness thing. Why?
It seems to me when we have difficulty with one nation indivisible, with liberty and justice for all, we can multiply that when we talk about a world in which we apply the same, now I was going to say political statement, that you're pointing out this is not intended to be a political statement, but we hear it politically, don't we?
I'm having a hard time understanding how you call that a political statement.
Well, it's it starts out as a theological statement. In God's purpose of creation, the human family is one. When we think of the final purpose in Christ, is to make of one people, all nations.
But when the moment you say you realize the oneness, you're in the politics, it seems to me, in one sense or another. The politics of making one.
Realize, actualize, or is it the common knowledge?
I think it's actualize.
I would question whether we have gotten to the point where we would agree that we acknowledge to come to that statement of actualization. I think of my own parish. To make that statement, to say it is not political, would, or even to say it is political but it is something God-given, would, is not a safe assumption to make for that parish. And I guess that's my problem of coming back now to jump to judgments on the basis of this assumption. I think I have to do work on the assumption first before I can even begin to now take on the judgments.
Yeah, and Carol's question, is anything being done to even address? I'd be curious to see what the LCA did with the statement. If they did anything except file it away, like we do with ours.
Yeah.
Well, it continues. It's been reprinted, and the sexist language has been cleaned up.
The other thing you need to ask for is what's the political statement?
Responding to what you were talking about, the Lutheran penchant for civil order, I think in some of the specific judgments that there's some real saleable kinds of approaches. I think the international legal order and a United Nations construct where things are ordered and legal and there are systems and assurances, I think that working toward goals like that with those kind of constructs, I think that they ring real true to people and they answer some of the questions about security and about equity and how, are we going to get taken advantage in this process? And you can talk about that the process of setting that up can be worked out so that there is, so that no nation kind of gets an upper hand, that we're all part of the same community. But that is the most difficult thing for the United States because it means suddenly becoming a part of a community rather than a stand-apart leader who is able to be fairly independent of other countries. And that's the real key.
Well,
yeah.
I think also, as you if you look at these things and consider the possible results, I mean, it means a lot of people in the United States. I mean, we're sort of the economic rapers of the world. And that simply can't continue. We can't continue to consume the way we do and expect a new world order to evolve.
But that would be a task of the church, I think, is to say in the United States, which is what we're talking about, or this is in Canada, it also includes Canada, is to help people to understand that what is being offered in the long run, we have something to gain. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. As long as it's interpreted as something that is going to cause us to lose something and recognizes that our Christian altruism is not that finely developed, that we immediately respond to that.